Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health Science and Energy Show. This would be January 17th, 2010. We're going to continue with what we were doing 2 weeks ago. And then after that, we're going to talk about some Andromedans. So let us continue on and go back 2 weeks to catch the first part of this. And here we go again.
I'm sure you understand what I'm going to cover now while I'm covering it. If there's any questions about electricity and magnetism, stop me. We'll go over it. I know some of you, this is so basic, it's ridiculous, and others, this is something new. So I want everyone to reach one mind in understanding this information. It's very important. Now, electricity consists of an electron and a proton. And let's look at our body for a second and understand something about the relationship of electricity and the reproduction of cells in the body and things like that. This is what I like to bring in now. You guys want to come in? I'll close this door here a little bit because I need this board. Just picking up all right? Let me go ahead. This will also help you understand ionization, too, and why it's so important to have ions in the air. If you just had oxygen in the air, you'd die in about 15 minutes. You have to have oxygen. When I say you die, I mean you lose your physical form. To me, death is just a form of ignorance, but you definitely can lose your body. Okay, now, on one level, we have an electron and a proton. Okay, this is our basic electrical particle here, electron and proton. We can imagine that to be on a macrocosmic, the Earth and the Moon. Now, the electron and the proton, this electron moves very fast around here. Now, size-wise, these particles are very small in the relationship of an atom. For example, if we were going to look at an electron and a proton in an orange, for example. Okay? We take our orange and we make it as big as the Earth. Then we look down at the surface of the Earth, which is now our orange, and we pick up a small particle about the size of a cherry, and that's one atom of the orange, the electron and the proton. Now, we bring that over here, and we put it on the board. Well, the proton is about the size of a grain of salt, and the electron can still not be seen, yet the relationship appears to be about that big. That's because the electron is moving so fast around the proton that it bends light rays. So our ignorance, we think this is a very dense thing when it's really that and something else you can't even see. So density becomes a limitation of the human mind due to the fact that we're acute and keyed into our five senses, and mass mind, mass consciousness has been programmed so long to only accept what they can see, feel, hear, and touch that we put a tremendous limitation on ourselves and entrapped ourselves into this illusion of Maya. That's the first thing I like to cover on electrons and protons. Now, we'll add this to another proton. Okay. Now we have a molecule. Okay. A molecule is the smallest form of energy containing chemical characteristics. Then we add one molecule to another molecule over here, and we have a cell. So we go from an atom to a molecule to a cell. The cell recombines again, and we have an organ. And remember, in man, we have seven basic organs called endocrine glands, producing seven basic sets of feelings, which gives us all attributes of the human personality. Organs have consciousness. Atoms have consciousness. Molecules, cells, organs are the first state of group consciousness inside of us. Each organ has a mind and a body of its own. That's why all the endocrine glands have their own individual colors, their own individual cell characteristics. Any biophysicist, or any biochemist rather, can look at any organ in the body, not just a piece of it, and he'll tell you that that's part of the liver, that's part of the adrenals. Because the science of cellular rejuvenation stems on the understanding that each individual organ forms its own level of consciousness and has its own chemical characteristics. The organs, of course, then form man over here. So we see a chain going right down the line. Begin to understand that. Now, going back to electricity, what's important to understand is this. The body reproduces cells continually. This system is constantly deteriorating. I often tell people about energy in form, and that is, it's right now it's 4:37 and 47 seconds. There is no 4:38. you'll create 438 just out of momentum from being here now at 437 in 14 to 15 seconds. So in order to do that, you've got to have electricity in your body, and you're going to regenerate 50 million cells in your body in 1 second if you're healthy. So every second, 50 million cells are being reproduced, and you need ions and electricity to do that. Unfortunately, we're running out of electricity in the atmosphere. That's where the body gets the electricity. It comes right out of the air, not a prana. We're running out. I'll explain that in a little bit. Now, basic electricity, like we show here, we're taking a piece of wire. And this piece of wire, what we're doing is we're connecting that to a battery. So here we have a piece of wire. We have a battery down here, a black box. It has a positive and negative terminal on it. Negative. The wire goes here. As soon as we connect the battery to the wire, the electrons start moving through here in the direction of negative towards positive, like this. And you have a magnetic field of current parallel to that. Now we can disconnect this and just have a piece of wire hanging right here and bring a north and a south pole piece of magnet up to the wire, and the magnetic field goes into the wire, and if you had a voltmeter connected down here where the battery was, you'll measure voltage in the wire. This is old science right here. So you begin to see that anytime there's electricity, there's magnetism. Anytime there's magnetism, there's electricity. So here I am wearing a pyramid, right? If I had a compass in my hand, I could hold it. I could measure the magnetic field of the earth, and it has got wires on it. So there's obviously something happening when I wear this pyramid. Now, the next thing, go ahead and put the next slide up now, Tom. The next thing we have to look at is alternating current, the science of vibration in the universe. Now, if we had a piece of wire here, let's say we had a magnet, north pole, south pole. Can you guys all see this? Okay. It has energy going, say, just for the sake of a statement here, let's say the energy goes from the north pole down to the south pole. There's a flow going that way. If you put your hand near it, let's say if you had an iron hand, it would be deflected that way, right? So the energy is going this way continually, like a ball. Well, if that's connected over here to a water wheel, like I've shown right here, and a piece of wire is set right here like this, when the wire is like this, by what is called mutual induction, the electricity will go in this direction. Now, if this magnet turns over, and the south pole goes to the top, the north pole goes to the bottom, the electricity is the same in the magnet, or the energy is the same, but to the wire, who is an outside observer, this has changed and gone the other direction. So every time I turn the magnet over, the electricity will go in one direction in the wire and then turn around and go in the other way. That's called alternating current, back and forth, back and forth. Now, this change, this rate of change, has a number system called octaves or vibrations attached to it. And they're always divided into sevenths. At one frequency it's sound, another it's light, another it's color, it's music. Everything we have is based on the frequencies of this change going on right here. Now in science, what we did is we produced this effect right here and then we applied it externally. This is an internal effect within the human body. This takes place inside the brain. This is the process of electrolysis whereby we metabolize the minerals, producing different vibrations. Okay, now let's talk about, let's say this is running at, say, one cycle per second. That means that the electricity goes to the right and the left, back and forth at a low rate, a low vibration. Now, certain things in nature happen at low vibration, low frequency. Example, algae, mold, bacteria occur at low frequency. Worms are low frequency devices, creatures of nature. So, let's take an apple tree for a second and show you what a pyramid can do in relationship to frequency on a very basic level. In the fall, the blood of the apple tree doesn't get out to the leaves anymore. In the spring, if the leaves are new, the sun is shining, and the leaf acts as a synthesis between the sap, which comes from the ground, and the sunlight, which comes from the sun. And the synthesis produces, of course, a flower. The flower then produces a pollen, and the bee, which is Venetian in origin, comes and pollinates the flower, and we produce an apple. So this is all high frequency. But as the fall comes, gravity starts pulling on that apple, bringing it back to the soil, and of course, as soon as the weather drops, the sap quits going up and the apple can't get any more vitality, so it starts to fall off the tree. It comes down off the tree. Well, if we left the apple alone, it would lower its vibration because the tree was a life force. So when the apple hit the ground, it would start to deteriorate and degenerate, and pretty soon it would invoke the worm. Now, the worm can come either from the ground or from the ethers themselves. They come from either place, and they're invoked either inside the apple or they crawl externally into the apple, depending on a lot of factors. Well, let's say we take that apple off the ground before it rots, or a worm gets to it, and we cut it in half, put half of it underneath the pyramid, we call that a control or experiment, put the other half, call it control, away from the pyramid. What will happen is the apple inside the pyramid will stay fresh for an indefinite period of time, maybe 6-8 months. The one over there will rot. Now, what will also happen, though, is the one inside the pyramid, even though it will stay fresh, it will lose its moisture unless you seal it. So the apple will be drying out without the interference of bacteria. Now, the federal government, when I put the pyramids on the people's heads back about, I guess it was 6-7 years ago in New York City, the first time we did it back there, they got nervous because somehow or other, they didn't believe in pyramids, but they believed they would dehydrate heads or people. So very quietly, they didn't want to just challenge me because I wasn't making any claims, but they didn't know whether to challenge me on that or not. And they knew that to make one of these stupid claims against somebody like myself without first documenting it, they'd have a lot of problems because I was one of them and had been for 10 years. So they spent very quietly, they took some of my pyramids and they spent $1 million in several different universities, funding 10 different universities, to find out and prove that maybe I was wrong. Well, at the end of all of this funding and all this behind the scenes that they were doing, the bottom line was when the pyramid is worn on the head, it raises consciousness. So they turned the report over to Flanagan, Pat Flanagan, who's now editing and writing a book about how the government found that wearing a pyramid raises consciousness. So that was quite interesting, you know. So anyway, that I'm just pointing that out because they do not cause dehydration. They only allow evaporation without the interference of bacteria. That's a misnomer that has arisen many times. Now, we'll start speeding this thing up. This water wheel now speeds up to 60 cycles per second. 60 cycles per second, the field builds up and collapses, builds up and collapses, and you get to where you can now hear it. And this continues on up to about 16,000 cycles. Now, if you look at the diagram, I've got the water wheel. Let's look at the magnet. Here's the north and the south pole. And we connect, here's a magnet turning over here. We connect this to a wire, and we ground out one side of the wire. Then if we have over here another coil just sitting there, wound like that with the ground on it, and we run this over, let's see here, a permanent magnet here, the north and the south pole, and then we put a piece of cardboard on the magnet. So when this energy goes north, this goes south, this will go south, this will go north, and back and forth, what will happen is this coil over here will pull this magnet back and forth. And when this magnet is pulling back and forth, it pulls this big air core back and forth and it releases sound. That's how a speaker works. You know, and so you can transmit sound that way, like a loudspeaker. Now, the human ear works exactly backwards from that. It receives vibrations coming through in the sound spectrum, which moves the diaphragm. The diaphragm then is attuned to a small network which connects to a nerve. The nerve, of course, goes into the brain, and the brain is the detector to move at and determine. The detector, of course, is programmed when you're a child by sounds. You ask your mother or father or whatever what this sound represents, what that sound represents. They give you a response. That conditions and that is a conditioned response, and this is a comparator. And you can go on and on with brains, you know, but this basically is what's happening. So we have the same thing going on, and then we have seven different patterns of sounds before the sounds start overlapping one another, and these are called octaves. And, of course, you all probably know the A, B, C, D, E, F. On the musical scale. Now, the human sound, the human ear can only hear, by most people, can only hear about 17,000 cycles per second. Dogs will hear 20,000 cycles per second. Dolphins will hear 100,000 cycles per second because they have a higher rate of exchange. So we can't say that sound is limited at what we hear. We can only say that sound has a certain range and we are limited by what we can perceive of sound. So when we go on past sound, then we go into the next frequency. We can continue rotating this now to say millions of cycles per second or half a million cycles per second. Well, when that happens, another thing begins to happen. Here we have a piece of wire. Remember the wire, we're vibrating now. The energy is being created. Every time the north pole goes by, every time the south pole goes by, we have energy over here. The faster that generator rotates, the faster this transition of this electron goes back and forth in here. It goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So the faster the wheel goes, the faster this goes. Well, pretty soon you start getting into a situation of stress. Just like we have stress in our bodies, we have stress on vibrations. And as we build up vibration, these crests between the positives and these crests between the negatives get shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. So we go to a shorter wavelength. Well, when they reach a certain length, what happens is they react off the Earth, because the Earth has a magnetic field, and they're propelled out into space. And this is called free propagation of radiation. And when this takes place, we transmit, you know, radio frequency. We transmit television frequency waves all around. It also takes place inside our heads, too, and we're able to transmit thoughts back and forth. But that's usually a different process than what I'm describing now. Now, finally we go so fast with our vibrations here, the wavelength and the energy is so high that the waves get so short that they become light.
And the eyes are high-frequency antennas that receive high-frequency magnetic energy. And so we see visible light. Now, within that spectrum are seven basic octaves or vibrations of light. The same as in the sound spectrum, there are seven different vibrations of sound. And, of course, we have the color band or the musical band, okay, which is A, B, C, D, E, F, diatonic scale. Wherever frequencies relate to one another, you know, in vibration, depending, it doesn't matter how far apart the vibration of the spectrum is, there are always seven crossing points in every spectrum, and these are called the octaves of that spectrum, okay? And we're going to talk about these things. So you've all got that down, your basic stuff, because where we go from here is the utilization of this very basic knowledge. And this, by the way, is about fifth and sixth grade science. Okay, that's about the level that this is taught at. Fifth and sixth grade so far. Okay? So don't think I'm out in the twilight zone. I'm going in the twilight zone, but I'm going to ground you out first. Okay? Next slide now.
Michigan when I was about 14 on atomic energy. And I went into the Air Force and I was an early morning radar. And I worked around our defense system and spaceships and flying saucers and all the things that the Air Force doesn't want to talk about. I got out of that, I went into aerospace and I worked with the late Wernher von Braun. We built spaceships. This was back in the mid-60s. And when I realized the Air Force was starting to turn me against the system, back in the late 50s, and by the time I got into the mid-60s, working for the government, you know, 10 years by this time, I was so turned against the system at this point in time that all I could do is couldn't even wait until the space programs ended, you know, but I somehow or other made it through to the end. Got real rebellious towards the end of the space program, my employer was Rockwell, but our contractor was NASA, and Rockwell was performing such a poor service for NASA, and it was the government's money, you know, people's money that was being spent, that I filed a large grievance on behalf of myself against Rockwell for NASA, and promptly got fired for doing that. So I was out of a profession, you know, I was a professional scientist by this point. And the grievance was about fire hazards and human consciousness, the awareness of the job on the birds. And we were having a lot of fires as a result of my grievance. These three people died down in the Cape. If you remember that one incident where the three astronauts died, and my grievance was to stop that from happening because I could see that happening. So when that happened, then they gave me my job back, then I resigned and I walked out. That was my end of the government spending. But I started studying with the Eastern teachers for quite a while. I spent a number of years with them and learned the Eastern way of life, which, when I studied Brahman science, it made a lot more sense than the American science, because when I was studying the quantum mechanics and quantum physics and things like that, all we would say in this country was that if you have a certain condition in a laboratory or an environment, a product, you know, a certain type of particle present, maybe something will happen, you know. And it didn't mean anything to me. So with the Brahman science, they had names for families of energy, so I really began to work seriously with energy. Then I finished my PhD in homeopathic medicine and came back and started lecturing with the National Health Federation. And since that time, it's been about 6-7 years since I've been doing that. And of course, we've been doing a lot of pyramid energies and developing the space travel devices that I was interested in developing back at NASA, but Uncle Sam wouldn't let us do that because it was a giant WPA project, and they figured it would be detrimental to the national economy to come on with these environmental projects too soon. They wanted to wait until we got into a situation like we are in now. The situation we're in now is that we've destroyed our water supply worldwide. We've raped our soil of minerals. Most people in the world are mineral deficient and not aware of it. And we're running out of air. So, you know, your feelings come from three different places. They come from, number one, your air. That's your first source of feelings. Second source of feelings comes from relationships, communication with each other, experiencing each other. And the third source of feelings comes from the food that we eat. Well, you can eat junk food for 10 or 15 years before it has a detrimental effect on the body. You end up with cancer or one of the diseases that you can have. It's your choice. You can have an argument with someone and have a bad relationship and still live on the physical plane for quite a while, maybe not feeling too well, or you can live in harmony. But if you just hold your breath for about 2 or 3 minutes and try to go out the door, you won't make it. So society has put a fuse on the you fuse yourselves, basically. I'm not saying I'm not part of it, because I'm just as guilty as the next person. I'm just one that's trying to do something about it. And you fuse yourselves with your air supply, even though you look out here and it looks fairly clear. There's a tremendous amount of smog out here, even now.
There ain't a lot of air up there. And when you realize how one of those big 747s with four engines on it, developing 56,000 pounds of thrust or horsepower, that's 200,000 horsepower being used per second, you know. That's a lot of air, you know, and the trees on the planet down here, which are supposed to rejuvenate our atmosphere, can't do that, because what are we doing? We're cutting our trees down, too, to build houses. Look at the price of wood. So you see the dilemma that we're going into? So we do have to have intervention now. It's necessary, because we got to destroy, you know, this imagination. The government, the corrupt government, will have to be eliminated, and man can't eliminate it. God has to. If man tries it, he's called a rebellion, you know, we're called rebels or whatever. So we're going into what is called a revolution. And that's called a spiritual revolution. Now, my great-great-grandfather was a leader of a revolution, Ethan Allen, in this country. And they started a war in 1776. And we had a problem there. You know, people have a tendency not to get into action, even when all the facts were presented. Now, in 1620, when we came over here, we left England, right? To get away from taxation without representation is what we're having again right now, the same problem. So first of all, we ran away from England. When we ran away from England, we came here. The English just waited for us to get settled in our colonies, and then they began to infiltrate us, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there. So finally the colonies were a joke in England. They would probe us with their red coat regulars, and they would keep a fear trip going, like, you know, the paranoia always manifests in these times. And they kept us going, and so we didn't do anything about it. It started to get real bad. Well, then we decided we're going to have to get away and run them out. So we asked them to leave, and of course they didn't leave. So we had to organize ourselves. So the first thing we had to do was make our organization up and decide what we wanted to base our rebellion on. So we tried to draw up the Constitution of the United States. But when it was written, nobody would sign it. Okay, and John Adams, one of the people that wrote it, had a hell of a time even getting it written, because there was such fight amongst the sons of the aristocrats, that were at that time our representatives, just like we have the same problems now. It's like having a bunch of representatives of oil companies. If you read some of the names back here on your chart, which is in the back room where the children are, you'll find that a lot of, like, Lynch was there, who has Merle C. Lynch today. And you'll see a lot of powerful families in running this greed trip today that signed that Constitution. And John Adams used to, you know, just absolutely tell them off, you know. And, of course, Benjamin Franklin was always soothing him and saying, well, this is the best you got to work with, man. You got to work with these people. So that conflict was going on simultaneously. It was George Washington, who has more of the sons of the aristocrats over at Valley Forge. And he's waiting at Valley Forge. He's running out of food, money, and supplies for somebody to sign a Declaration of Independence so that he can start a war, you know, start shooting. But there's this huge stalemate. Nobody would do anything. Well, Ethan Allen came along. He was very rebellious, and he knew of both stalemates. And he was going on the inner levels. Well, we're always guided. I'll show some films later on today. Did that TV set arrive, by the way, it was supposed to come? We're going to need that later. Otherwise, we'll use mine, which is very small. And you'll see that there is an inner hierarchy, which we'll talk about late this afternoon, that guides this country. And so they got a person by the name of Saint Germain came and appeared on the balcony inside the Continental Congress room at a meeting and got him to sign that document. He gave a heck of a delivery of a speech, and this energy that he released motivated everybody to sign the document. Well, superphysically, Ethan Allen picked up on it, and he organized 50 people into a bridge in Lexington, Massachusetts, and he opened fire, just fire on a bunch of British regulars, just shot them down, you know. Then he went to Fort Ticonderoga, okay, and in the middle of the night, and the general was asleep, but he had 50 men. He says, wait outside, took a musket, took it up, went to the general's quarters and stuck it down his throat and said, pull the hammer back and says, surrender, you know. The guy had no choice, so they go out in the courtroom, and 800 soldiers come out half-dressed and put their guns in a pile, and they'd taken Fort Ticonderoga. Then Ethan Allen sent a message down to George Washington and said, told of the massacre the day before and the capture of the fort that night, and he says, you better get rolling, because we, as soon as the British find out about this, they're going to be shooting at you. So then away, then the war started. So that was the beginning of our war and our freedom. Well, the premise of the war, and it was George Washington, he was in the lodges, he was a Freemason and that. And our forefathers dedicated this land to the New Age people. They knew in the New Age that their sons and daughters would be the reincarnations of the Atlantean civilization, you know, the good side of the Atlantean civilization. They would inherit the American soil. They knew this. The next thing happened was we had to symbolize this on the dollar. This is what we chose. So three other Lodge brothers, Van Buren, who became a president, Tyler, Eugene Lafitte, the pirate, got together, and they were also into the secret inner teachings and guidance of the countries, and they coined the Great Seal of the United States as a pyramid. This was in 1779. But the Continental Congress, which was a secondary, what I would say, level of consciousness, could not understand what the leaders were all about, even at that time, so they wouldn't put that symbol on the dollar bill until 1939 on the Series A dollar bill. So you begin to see that there's a tremendous gap between the true leaders of this country and the followers that have to take care of the pragmatics. In other words, there's a big gap between the president and the congressman or the senator. But as time went on, our beautiful values, the country became very rich, and when it became very rich, it became lazy. And that's the story of civilization, you know. You feed a lion real well, he doesn't go out and hunt anymore. He just lays around and lets the women do it, you know. And so the woman in this case was the women in this country. They physically went to work, and they were treated like hell. So we had the rebellion of the women. The women were doing everything in the early, you know, in a lot of manufacturing things in the late 1800s, early 1900s, in England and here too. And so you begin to see all of the things that go on in corruption beginning happen, and it happened. So we got some dues to pay. That's all there is to it. We have some dues at this time. So now we have the New Age leaders, people like myself. And we know, we can see, because we have the foresight to see what has been. And we're not afraid to admit where we are now. And that's why I wear my dust cap here, this pyramid, because I'll leave this thing on until, number one, I've cleaned the air back up. Number two, I've restored the food back, the soil back to its original condition. And number three, polluted the, got rid of the air, water pollution. I'll do all three of those things. I may do it alone, or I'll do it with the help of anyone that wants to join me. And there are quite a few organizations now that are doing it, you know. Because my children are not going to, I'm not going to leave this planet without leaving it cleaned up for my kids, you know, and their generations. I have enough courage and enough respect for God at this point in the universe to, I don't care what has been done, I'm not going to say that my state is because of that. I'm going to change the state that I'm in by changing my state. So we begin to start somewhere. So I'll start with a slideshow now and show you about our own temples a little bit.
Well, we start with the root of the body, which is the colon. In the yogis and the new yoga, it's the sacral chakra. But the primary organ in the body where all disease and degeneration begins is the large intestine.
How many of you in here have been to Colin lectures? Anybody in here? All of you? Well, you have. Okay. And most of the main topic of the National Health Federation, and each of us has a part, like Dr. Yamayamas and Dr. Ellis and that are covering a lot with fluoridation and the effects of the water. In other parts of the country, we're talking a lot about colon therapy, and when I do most of my lectures with the National Health Federation, it's on the topic of poison environments and atmosphere and oxygen on the body. So now, the large intestine digests all of the minerals coming into the body. And my specialty in medicine is homeopathic medicine. I'm a homeopathic physician. So this is one of my degree areas where I've studied and specialized for the last several years. And we find that most people have colons that look like this rather than like this. 90% of people coming into our clinics look like that. And what's happening is why they look like this, they're shriveling up like this. This is the dehydrating effect right here. This is the descending colon where it goes for release out. This is dehydrated due to what, this is what preservatives and food substances will do for you. It dehydrates the colon. Proper irregularity causes a stretching action in the colon. And most people that have had a heart attack and lived from it did not have a heart attack at all, but the colon was stretched up, like on this one, up against the heart, and causes a cardiac restriction. So a heart attack has one symptom, death. Pseudo heart attack has cramping and everything like a heart attack, but there's not really a heart attack. A lot of people have had this symptom here. And of course, when they give nitroglycerin, this will help it because it forces the heart muscle into contraction and restriction back and forth, so it forces this away. But the ideal thing is colon therapy. A lot of people that are hyperactive, people come to me and say they're hyperactive, they've got too much energy, and they're jumping around like a nervous cat. It's not caused by an overactive adrenal and lots of adrenaline in the blood. It's caused by poisons in the blood. Okay? When I studied with the Tibetans put me through an exercise as a final initiation before I left their lamasaric care. And that's where large amounts of strychnine were placed in my body. Enough strychnine was placed in my body to kill 50 people. And that was to give the experience of what they call a death experience. And when this large amount of strychnine was placed in my body, I was taught certain meditation exercises, certain physical exercises, and certain yoga exercises, which I had to combine to move the poison out of my body so that I would not lose my form. The experience was very, very euphoric, but it was very rigid on the body. It was very nauseous. The American Indians did the same experience with the peyote button. They used to take the peyote button because any of these experiences stop the flow of serotonin on the pineal gland, which we'll cover in a little while, causing a spiritual experience or a revelation of our higher nature. It's suddenly brought before us. And I found that with a strychnine in my body, I had an excessive amount of energy. It did not stimulate the adrenaline. It gave me an excessive amount of energy. And this was a 3-day ritual out on a desert. So what I had to do with the strychnine is I had to do running. I had to physically run for a certain length of time. Then I had to sit in what is called a kundalini position and do a large amount of breathing exercise where you go. What this did was put large amounts of oxygen into the bloodstream so that the oxygenated blood in the liver could take the poison from my body. And this exchanging process of large amounts of oxygen and excessive running and the meditation that went with it caused a complete discharge of the poison. And this would happen, it would come in rushes. There would be 3 or 4 hours of meditation and peace. Then the system would pick up a large amount of strychnine and go into like a spasm. We'd have to work through that and go into a peaceful thing. And each time as the poison decreased in the body, it pulled out other toxins with it. And the experience was a very high euphoric experience on the second day. The American Indians did the same thing, the same exercise as the Tibetans, so they did it with a rattlesnake bite. The rattlesnake bite, where the grave was put in a circle of rocks in a sacred burial ground or a sacred ground, and they had the blessings of the tribe. So this kept the air purified during this out-of-body experience so that some low influence didn't take the body, and the grave would let the snake bite him several times on the first day, and then he would be on a fast for 3 or 4 days, maybe 7 days. And there was no administration to the poison in the body. It was not removed. It was consumed and converted. So that means that a human being with colon problems, with worms, can absorb the poison, can utilize the poison, but it's not the best way to go, and it's not a desirous experience. So the idea is to remove these things. The second thing that we find in colon therapy is the small intestine feeds the large intestine, and there's a valve called the ileocecal valve. Most people have a jammed or blocked ileocecal valve. I was a vegetarian for 7 years before I had my first colonic, and I had a blocked valve. So when we put the barium in through here, the barium not only showed the deficiencies in the large intestine, but it went up in the small intestine as well. So the oxygen water treatments that they give to get rid of this condition will also open this valve and it will cause it to work properly. Okay? And digestion is an important thing to understand. And basically, the way the digestive process works in the human being is this. The enzyme is a chemical product or a chemical property that we all have. We have different enzymes to break down different foods. And the enzyme goes in on a chemical reaction, but is not consumed by that chemical reaction. So if we eat some food, and that's going to be broken down to form protein, certain enzymes are always required. Now the body can only process so many enzymes at a time. That's why they'll tell you to mix carbohydrate and fruit, or fruit and protein, or carbohydrate and protein, but not to mix fruit and vegetables, things like that, certain combinations, because the body cannot manufacture all these enzymes and produce them and digest them and process them in the stomach. So you end up with some kind of an alimentary canal problem because you combine the wrong foods. That's why we have these little food charts out now. And a good thing that I learned from Pablo Arroyo, which I've always done, is that when you eat salads, eat your salad last in a meal. Don't eat it first. Because the salad distributes the hydrochloric acid all over the stomach. So the hydrochloric acid is needed along with the digestive enzyme pepsin to break down large fat molecules. So those of you that are eating meat and other heavier foods, if you eat the salad first, there's no hydrochloric acid left. So what happens is the meat is pushed on down through the alimentary canal and ends up impacting the colon and constipation as a result. So eat the salad last. That's why in Europe they always serve the salad last. So now when you eat food, you start chewing the food, the first thing you do is you start releasing enzymes. Okay? The enzymes are released in the saliva. They're stored in the salivary ducts. It's inside the mouth. The food with the enzyme is brought down into the stomach. There, it combines and begins to form the amino acids. The amino acids are called peptides and polypeptides. The best reason not to eat meat with the formation of these amino acids, because if you look at the peptides in an animal and the peptides in a human being, the peptides are in an animal are different than a human being, and the human body cannot absorb the aminos properly. An example of that, I'll just draw a typical thing right here. Here, these would be like papain, pepsin, and that. These would be peptides forming polypeptides, and they're carbon atom chains in the body. Now, the first one would represent a chain, and when these things are lined up like this, you have a complete amino acid. If in the case of an animal, you need an animal product, the first three might line up, the second three might line up, and they're absorbed, and they become denser. So this is an amino acid that's already in the body. This is the one to be digested. And as they digest, they combine chemically, making the nucleus of each amino more dense or solid. But in the case of an animal, maybe the first six would combine, but the last three would not. So you get a cancellation reaction. So two-thirds of the animal product did something, and one-third didn't. The one-third that didn't, what it does is causes an allergic condition in the body. And immediately when anybody eats meat, if you measure your blood pressure and your heartbeat, the blood pressure always goes up 20 to 30% with any person ever eating meat. Now, when the blood pressure in the heartbeat goes up 20 to 30% on the eating of meat, immediately causes the heart to go up in this rate, and it causes more heartbeats. The heart has X number of billions of beats in a lifetime, and if you're constantly eating meat, you're shortening the lifespan of the heart. The next condition that happens is in the arteries in the skin, the epithelial cells. And what happens there is if you look at the skin, here's the surface of the skin, I'll draw it here, right here, coming up like this. And epithelial cells in the arteries, the way the blood supply, it comes up, it makes a sharp bend at the surface of the skin, and comes back down again. Well, what happens is when you're eating meat, the allergenic response causes an erosion at the top part of this blood vessel where it comes out to the surface of the skin. Just like if you had like the Mississippi River, when certain rains come, it starts eroding out certain banks on the outside. This happens every time you eat meat. When this happens, the body has to repair that damage, and that's what cholesterol is for. So the body immediately, when this toxic condition comes on, starts secreting cholesterol. So that therefore, every time you eat meat, It causes a erosion of the arteries, an increase in heartbeat, increase in blood pressure, and then a secretion of cholesterol. That's why a lot of people on high cholesterol and low cholesterol diets can't get the same results, because some of them on a high cholesterol are meat eaters and some of them aren't. Okay? That's the reason why, because of that toxic reaction. Whereas a vegetable protein, like a tomato, for example, won't cause this reaction in the body. Now, I'm not saying those of you that are eating meat don't do like I did. When I learned all these medical facts about meat eating, I immediately stopped eating meat, instantly. Just right there, triple Leo, right? No more meat eating. And what I did 2 years later is I went into protein deprivation. And when protein deprivation went manifested on me, I came one day, I was looking, I had a normal arm, and all of a sudden this area in my arm turned bright red and swelled up a half an inch. And every portion of my body, this area of my chest, swelled up, became bright red, swelled up a half an inch. Areas on my legs, here, here, and here. My face, my cheeks swelled up, and my neck. So I was like a patchwork quilt. That condition lasted for 4 hours, and then it completely went neutral again, and the area that was swollen red went neutral, and the area that wasn't swollen swelled up. And I did that for 2 weeks. And then finally I found out that I had protein deprivation, and one of my teachers at the School of Axialism in San Diego, I went down there to him and asked him what's happening to me. I'm flashing hot, flashing cold. I couldn't feel any mental changes, but I knew that something was wrong with my body. He said, protein deprivation. He sat me down and says, you're going to have a steak. And I said, wait a minute. I can't digest meat. I haven't had a piece of meat in 2 years. He says, bet me. And he started frying the steak on the stove, and that smelled good. And I sat down and I ate that whole steak, and I felt so good afterward. And my body immediately was recovered from that. Didn't bring that shock anymore. So if you go off meat, don't go off it. You know, immediately go off it over a period of 7 years. It takes 7 years for the body to regenerate a complete set of organs. And all of the endocrine glands have different hormones in them and different enzymes in them that have trained us to digest and assimilate the food as we know it in our habitual patterns. So when you make a transition, make one transition 7 years. If you're going off meat, eat it 7 days a week, cut it down for the first year to say 5 days a week. And alternate your fish and your meat and your chicken, like that. You have a question?
Is there a difference between vegetarian protein and animal protein?
Yeah, there is. There is. It's in the chemical structure. And it breaks down in polypeptides, like I was telling you about. There is a difference, right? Animal protein is very close to human protein. Now, eggs, things like that, are closer. Eggs are good for you. The rule that I always learned from my teachers, and I found that it works, if it falls off a tree, what's it going to do? It's going to rot. You know, it's common sense. A chicken lays an egg. Somebody doesn't eat the egg, it rolls off on the floor and breaks. So I'm not saying in vegetarianism, abstain from protein totally. No, I eat eggs, I eat butter. These are natural byproducts of the animal. I just don't eat the animal itself. Chicken is not good for you, not because the chicken is not so good, it's because what the chickens are fed and raised. When I lived in Arkansas, we raised chickens. We raised a chicken in 19 weeks. We fed it full of chemicals, and it just swelled out. This is a protein swelling. And most of the chickens that we raised had cancer or pneumonia when we would pick them up. They'd have growths on them, tumors, or they'd be breathing so bad, tremendous amounts of pneumonia. Because the chickens were growing so fast, and there was very little attention taken to their actual health. All they wanted to do was make them grow fast. And they were just a big mucus bag, so they weren't that good. So you're better off on fish. Fish is your best bet. And red meat better than chicken. Although in the old days, you've been better off eating chicken versus red meat. The idea is to rotate the meat when you're eating it. Now, the next thing is, when you digest, you chew the food up, mix with the enzyme, it goes down into the upper part of the stomach and the small intestine. Here, it's broken down from protein to carbohydrates. Now, the carbohydrate is like an explosive or volatile mixture in the small intestine when it gets down here, just above the ileocecal valve. The last part of digestion, when it's turned into carbohydrate in the lower part of the small intestine, this is what's called the last part of the Krebs cycle. And during the last part of the Krebs cycle, the liver secretes bile and the pancreas secretes insulin. So in the presence of carbohydrate, insulin, and bile comes oxygen through the airstream, through the lungs. And as soon as oxygen hits this mixture, it ignites in the body, producing body heat, and electricity, magnetism, and all the things that give us that warm feeling, that takes place in this area down here. So that's your last stage of digestion. Then, the fiber material that is not exploded is then moved out through the ileocecal valve after the heat process and out in the large intestine where the minerals are now extracted. The vitamins are taken out here and the minerals come out through here. And this chart, if you could read it clearly, shows you which each one of these folds breaks down a particular mineral. The science is down to that degree right now. And this iridology is very good at this point, because when you look at iridology, each one of these folds has an optic fiber going out to the eyes. So an iridologist can see by each part in the eyes, as you look at the eyes all the way around the outside of the iris, you can see the actual shape of the colon. The same thing is these fibers also go to the fingertips, so when we use Krillian photography, we can see the electrical shape. He's looking at an optical shape, I'm looking at an electrical shape. So this is why the Krillian photography is so beneficial in diagnosing the colon. And we're able, through Krillian photography, and then using the barium x-ray, we can actually determine that. Because we put a small amount of barium in the water inside the body, and an x-ray, it shows up as an actual glow like that. So now we can diagnose the comparison between the x-ray, the iridology, and the Krillian photography. That's how we got the Krillian photography evolved to where it is today, by these comparisons. Because in the holistic movement, everybody's working as brothers, and we're communicating and sharing our knowledge all the time. So it gives us total knowledge of each other's respective fields. So it makes us, gives us a wider degree of presentation. Now, man expresses himself on the physical plane with his inventions and his achievements in science. And everything that he presents is nothing more than a reconstitution of his own atomical workings within his body. For example, an automobile engine. An automobile engine, through the carburetor, takes oxygen and mixes it with gas. This is drawn into the cylinder pressure, and the piston goes up and compresses that air mixture. Then a spark plug ignites it, causing a combustion action, pushing the spark or the piston back down, which is on a crankshaft, creating work. Then there's two valves. One valve open to let the air charge and gas charge in, and then closed during for combustion. And then as the piston went down, another valve opened, and we had exhaust. In an automobile engine, one of the problems that lies is improper combustion causes a building up of carbon, which causes the combustion not to be very accurate or efficient anymore, so the engine loses horsepower. The second thing that happens in an automobile engine is the exhaust valve starts getting a carbon incrustation as a result of this problem down here of improper combustion. So when the cylinder comes up, you get leakage in the pressures and you don't get complete combustion. The human body, strangely enough, has the same problem. The compression cycle is when the food comes down into the small intestine and is compressed because of peristaltic action. It actually is under pressure. Okay? And then when the bile comes in and the insulin comes in from the pancreas and is ignited by the oxygen and electricity, it creates a small pressure. And then the ileocecal valve opens, and that pressure forces that fiber out. So it's a completion of that combustion cycle going through that ileocecal valve that forces this thing right here, and this peristalsis continues. So it's a pressure combustion cycle. Human beings have the same problem. They take the fruit, they eat vegetables, they get improper combustion in the small intestine. This causes unburnt materials to go out, and this ileocecal valve becomes jammed. And pretty soon what happens is, this material here gets halfway through here and then starts going backwards and pushing it right back up in the small intestine. And that's when you start getting into disease conditions, and one of those is cancer of the colon. So you begin to see the comparison between an ordinary automobile engine, understand how it works and how the body works. It's really not that complicated. It's understand we've got to have clean burning or clean digestive by good, adequate habits, by understanding that what kind of gasoline we're taking into our systems. And by keeping this system clean. In an automobile engine, every once in a while we take the heads off and give it a valve job. In the colon, a little colonics, and if you don't want to go get a colonic, a coffee enema is highly, highly suggested. So this removes the sluggish, tired feeling within ourselves when we understand to keep the system flowing properly. 2,000 years ago they were doing this. It even mentions it in the Bible. They're using it with gourds. Okay? Now, one of the important things that this will help you do is one of my problems. I was a very sick person. This is how I got into medicine. I was born with polio. I have right now a slightly sunken chest. I have a scar right here from an appendix operation where I had a wiped out colon. Okay, I had asthma so bad that when I was 6 years old, they used to put tubes up in my nose to drain them. And I had some other diseases too. So I was sick. And the doctors used to give up on me. I was the sickest kid around, but I became very healthy by mastering all these things. But one problem I used to have is every year in the fall, the Asian flu would come around. They'd make up all these flus and they'd come around and I'd get them. Then the springtime would come, everybody's healthy, and I'd come down with a flu in the springtime, and there wasn't even going around a virus at that time. What was happening was
I was getting the flu. The virus had settled in my stomach. And during the winter, we have a tendency to keep ourselves warm. We find that by eating denser foods in the wintertime, remember I was a meat eater then too, this would impact that colon. That virus would be lodged in here. Springtime would come and start exercising, getting out. My body would say, let's eat a little bit of fruit. It's here. I start eating fruit and I get a slight elimination. I automatically detoxify to a degree because our bodies are trained to do that. And what happens is I'd open up part of this wall of this intestine right here, and the virus would be exposed to the bloodstream. So I'd pick up last year's virus, and down I'd go with the disease again. This happens to a lot of people. So it's called reinfection. You know, a lot of people reinfect themselves, especially with the runny nose and cold virus. So that's the most notorious one, and that's stored in this large intestine here. So now in the body, when this is working, we assimilate the minerals. Minerals represent 5% of our body, but they control 95% of the enzyme and the digestion of vitamins in the body. So the mineral controls the entire body. That's homeopathic medicine. That's the science of that change.
I like to look at minerals as vibration. Now, minerals are taken up in the large intestine and carried up to the brain and stored in the brain cells in the mitochondrion of each cell inside the brain. They are released by the thinking process, which is produced by action on the physical plane when the human body digests food in the Krebs cycle, producing body heat and magnetism in the presence of prana carried in the air supply, and then has an encounter with another being or another energy. This releases mineral. There's quite a bit that's going on to cause this to take place. And you can, not only can you know whether you are deficient in minerals or not, but you can do a simple analysis on yourselves and tell which minerals you're deficient in. Example, we have three classes of minerals, and they're divided into vibration or octaves, which I'll cover in a few minutes. Okay, the first class, I always do it backwards, the first class are low frequencies. These are minerals like iron, copper, things like that. Then we have a middle, which is chrome. Remember, chrome on automobiles. And then we have the high frequency, which is gold. And all the precious metals that go with gold, vanadium, titanium, things like that. In our bodies, we have three different nervous networks to distribute this electricity, these electrical pulses, at different vibrations determined by the minerals. The lowest frequency network of distribution in our bodies is the autonomic nervous system. When copper and zinc and iron are digested by the body and carried up to the brain, this causes the subconscious body functions to take place, circulation, breath, respiratory, heartbeat, things like that. When you digest the middle octave, the thinking process becomes consciousness distributed through the sympathetic nervous network. Thoughts, when you dissolve chrome and all the middle octave elements, you like, let's go to the store, I'm cold, I feel warm. These basic movement pragmatic feelings come from the dissolution of those minerals. Then when you dissolve the precious elements like gold and titanium and molybdenum and vanadium and things like that, the thoughts are higher, of the spiritual nature, of God, of the inner ways of life. And these are distributed through what is called the vagus nerve, or the parasympathetic nervous network, the 10th cranial nerve, whatever you call that nervous network. It's the power supply that runs the little voice inside of our head that tells us to do or not to do something that ego often goes against. And then, of course, the little voice is usually right, and the ego, through action, shows us that we should have done what we were supposed to do by listening to ourselves a little bit closer. So if you find yourself deficient, if you're anemic, you know you're deficient in iron, if you're too lackadaisical and you can't think about basic survival, then you're lacking in the middle frequency vibrations. If you're having problems with meditation, you're preoccupied when you're trying to reach out to God, then you can bet that you're deficient on the higher frequency minerals. I mean, this is just basic mineral deficiencies that we're talking about now. So, the first thing that I always tell people is to get on a program of cleansing. I usually recommend coffee enemas if you can't afford to go to a clinic, or there isn't one around. Some people don't have them near them, but do oxygen therapy and things like that. We just do coffee enemas. And we use kava coffee. It's a very good coffee for that. And it's a tremendous high when you do an enema. Believe me, I know I've done many of them. It may not sound all that exciting, but once you've done a few of them, they can be very habit-forming. And it's a good habit to form. And I always recommend that you use kava because it's a low-acid coffee. You don't want a decaffeinated coffee. You want a deacidified coffee. Because caffeine in the large intestine has a drawing effect. It draws all the toxins and poisons out of the body. Then it stimulates the liver. The liver then puts large amounts of bile. Bile causes the stool to look very yellow, like a young baby. But it has a tremendous cleansing effect on the body. One coffee animal will cleanse you for about 2 days. If you're doing any fasting, I'm sure a lot of you do fasting, about the third day of the fast is a good time to start doing